You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Streaming at WPKN.org. This is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Cantavero of History Counts, filling in for Scott Harris, host of Counterpoint. We'll be with you until 10 o'clock tonight. We have two very interesting guests for you tonight, and after the interviews, we'll be taking calls. We'll give out the phone number later in the program. In our first hour, we'll be talking with environmental activist and radio show host Pauline Cantwell about cap and trade. That has to do with CO2 emissions. We'll also talk with her about geoengineering, jet contrails, and extreme weather. During the second hour, we'll speak with geopolitical analyst Rick Rozoff about the U.S. global military expansion, which you may not know goes far beyond Iraq and Afghanistan. But first, Gus and I are going to take a look at some of the important news stories of the past week. Maybe you saw last week on CNN that the cost of the war on terror has now reached $1 trillion. What do you make of that, Gus?
Sorry about that. Working out the kinks. I'm thinking that is nothing but chump change, actually. That should be...
Have we gotten our money's worth? How are things going?
Absolutely. How could you say you're not getting your money's worth out of that? We got more opium than we could take. And there's just... It's a complete mess. There's no other way to make sense of this war other than we're creating more terrorists by the minute. We're enriching and lining the pockets of the independent contractors out there. We're destroying the lives, the morale of the troops, and we're making a lot of homeless people and children without parents out there, that orphans that need to be taken care of.
Yeah, we talk about the cost of the war and money, but of course, so many troops are coming home injured, and this $1 trillion does not include the cost of taking care of them, these brave young men and women who were injured physically and mentally by the war.
You know, what's been in the news this past weekend was Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, how he released another 81,000 pages of secret documents that reveal some very disturbing things like rape, torture, abuses of personal rights. And
these are committed by our Afghan allies,
our own soldiers, our own generals, commanders, independent contractors.
It's been quite a week of revelations. It almost brings to mind the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, back during the Vietnam War. Last week, on July 23rd, CNN had an interview with Mark Waldman. And Waldman is a Harvard Kennedy School of Government academic who wrote a report on the Afghan War for the London School of Economics. And he was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer, and I think like a lot of viewers, I was shocked when Waldman talked about how the Pakistan's ISI, now Pakistan is nominally our strong ally in Afghanistan, has actually been covertly arming, supporting, and to a large extent controlling the Taliban within Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And this is in spite of the fact that we give them something like $1 billion in aid. And this report by Waldman then was followed up on Sunday with, as you mentioned, the WikiLeaks release of thousands and thousands of formerly secret, they call it a trove of secret military field reports that again show that the Pakistan ISA was supporting the Afghan Taliban, allowing representatives of the ISA to meet directly with the Taliban at secret strategy sessions and organize networks of militant groups. These reports also reveal that the ISA was organizing suicide squads that were operating in Afghanistan during the presidential election to try to disrupt them.
Right.
So and they've even gone so far as helping to organize and participating in Taliban offensives against American soldiers.
And that's not all. In July 19th, LA Times, where there is an article write-up about General Petraeus's. The headline is Petraeus's risky militia maneuver for Afghanistan. Arming local villagers is a page out of Army General David H. Petraeus's strategy in Iraq, but it carries substantial risks in warlord-ridden Afghanistan. Does that not sound familiar? Does that not coincide with the way we handled the Soviets by creating the Mujahideen? We armed them. We gave them Stinger missiles. We gave them guns. We gave them training. Go out and fight our enemies for us. Years later, we're fighting those same guys.
And you mentioned the Stinger missiles. Our governments often claimed that when our helicopters are down that they're accidents, but now these reports reveal that, in fact, the Taliban in Afghanistan has access to these missiles.
And they've got American fingerprints on them because they were made here. We gave them to them. You know, if I want to play a clip that backs up what I'm saying, it's Secretary Clinton in an interview on Fox News, basically admitting to the exact same thing that I'm saying. And listen to her choice of words and the nuances to the way she says it, because it kind of sounds like she really doesn't want to admit it, but it's already kind of out of the bag and coming out of her mouth, so she may as well just go ahead and say it. And I'm going to play that clip right now. She's being interviewed by Greta Van Susteren.
We're building a relationship that just did not exist. I said in our last trip when you were with me that we had a huge trust deficit, in part because the United States had, to be fair, we had helped to create the problem we're now fighting.
How?
Because when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, we had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan, and then we said, great, goodbye, leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well-armed, creating a mess, frankly, that at the time we didn't really recognize. We were just so happy to see the Soviet Union fall, and we thought, okay, fine, we're okay now. Everything's going to be so much better. Now you look back, the people we're fighting today, we were supporting in the fight against the Soviets.
Wow.
So what are we doing there?
And then wow.
to what are we doing there? And why, you know, I referred to the CNN calling it a $1 trillion war on terror. But that was a name that Bush gave to it. I don't think Obama uses it as much. But what is this war really about? Is it about terrorism or is it really about the valuable pipeline routes through Afghanistan into Pakistan from the former Soviet republics?
I wish I had the simple answer to that.
I think it's about the money. I think it's always about the money. And as we look down through history, these wars are always about resources. And as we're going to hear later from Rick Rosoff, there are wars going on for all over the world for resources.
Yeah, why don't we give a rundown of what we're going to be talking about later on?
Sure.
We have our first guest due up in about 5 minutes is Pauline Cantwell. And she's going to be talking about geoengineering, cap and trade, financial implications of global warming, because it's not just about saving polar bears and wildlife and the temperature and flooding, and it's so much more than that. It's about making money off of something, you know. Just like Rahm Emanuel said, his famous quote is "Never let a good problem go to waste."
That's very true. There are always money-making possibilities. And one of the problems that's a theme of history counts is the extent to which our government especially since World War II, has become the captive of corporate interests. And we face a situation now where we're really in a nominal democracy. And we have a problem, we have an answer, which is fashioned by corporations for their own benefit. And the interests of the American people always are in the back seat. Whether you're looking at Obama's health care reform, where he invites the health industry in to formulate the plan, or Bush's energy policy, where Cheney has secret meetings with Enron and other energy companies, the people of the United States don't have a seat at the table anymore.
Well, before any problem can be properly addressed in this country, they have to spend the time and interview every single lobbyist to find out who can benefit off of it before
it. Maybe we could, as part of our budget-saving measures, we could just eliminate the United States Congress, get rid of the House and the Senate, and just have the country run directly by the lobbyists. And then maybe at the beginning of the year, we could ask the stronger lobbying groups to come in and ask them, how much money do you want? The taxpayers write up a check.
Pony up the cash.
And they just go away and let us go on with our lives.
You know, one of the solutions, I think, actual solutions, is to go back to the old way of electing senators, which is that there is no popular election for senators. And that may sound, oh my God, that's so undemocratic of you. How could you say that? Well, the way that they used to do it was that you elect your representative. The representatives would then elect your senator, who could then be recalled at any time. So if your local control with your representatives within your state, they have to listen to you. If you want the senator recalled because he's not voting the way you think he should be voting, they recall him.
I wonder if our country has gotten
a six-year term. That's incredible.
It's
six-year
years.
Term.
And maybe, and of course, in order to run for the Senate, I mean, $20, $30, $40 million it's just a standard. Even to run for the House, I sometimes wonder if perhaps the country's just gotten too big. I mean, you have 600,000 people are represented by one congressman today, and spending millions to get dollars to get one of of those seats is considered normal now.
Well, I think case in point, the problem with the situation is that if a person is willing to spend 30 times more than he'll make from the job, then there's a problem.
You've got to wonder. Yeah.
There's a problem. The reason he wants that job must be called into question.
Yeah,
and there is
yeah.
no senator seat in the country. You look at the smallest states, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont. Those senators are getting multi-million dollar donations from every single bank, every corporation.
So the corrupting influence of the big money is just incredible, and the concentration of power in the Washington and big business is really undermining our democracy.
Yes.
And it's not a left-right issue. It's the people versus a corporate elite that's running. So it doesn't
right.
matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican or a liberal conservative. We're really cut out of the picture here.
No, it's a corporate issue. And as long as corporations have more to gain than the American people have to gain, this country will never be free. And it'll never be realized. It'll never be the dream realized.
Well, we're going to take calls after our first guest, and we'll give out the number after Ms. Cantwell finishes. So I hope that listeners will come in and weigh in on it. We're not shy about giving our opinions, and the airways belong to the public. So please
right.
call in and let us know what you think. Would you like to take a musical break?
Should I give the number out ahead of time? Or?
Why don't we give it out when
later on? Okay.
when Ms. Cantwell is finished?
All right. Well,
so we'll take a music break.
Take
and then
a break
we'll
now.
Up,
we're going to bring up our first guest, and we'll be back in a few minutes. All right, we're back live, and we have a guest with us. It's Pauline Cantwell, and we're going to be talking about, as we said before, geoengineering, cap and trade, and some rather weighted topics. Pauline, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, great to speak
Hi.
With you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Pauline.
Nice
it's Ken here.
Thank you.
Okay, so why don't you introduce yourself to the listening audience and just tell them a little bit about yourself, you know, your work at the UN, and how you got interested in geoengineering and its implications.
Well, I've been at the UN since 1994.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought in by Peace Action to bring the military issues to the table of the Summit for Social Development mm-hmm. in Copenhagen. And so I formed a peace caucus at that time, and have served as convener since then. And we have tried to bring the military issues to the table of different conferences, such as Istanbul, Habitat, and Johannesburg, follow-up to the Rio Summit.
Okay.
And so I always considered myself a facilitator, you know, got the best speakers that were out there and put together panels and programs. But I found nobody was really tackling the subjects of weather warfare.
Right.
And so about 8 years ago, I started studying weather warfare, you know, with the intention of writing a book, not knowing that Al Gore was going to embark on this global warming campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so I served on the climate change conference at the UN in 2007.
Okay.
And that's the annual non-government organization conference. And I was able to bring in Rosalind Peterson from California, president of Agriculture Defense Coalition, as a keynote speaker for that conference.
And for those who don't know, Rosalind is very, very knowledgeable and becoming quite a recognizable figure in this movement.
Yes, she is. And she is, her research is absolutely solid.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I give speeches at the UN, I make sure that the information I put out there, it, you know, can be verified.
Right.
It's not speculation. And so both Rosalind and I work on that premise that we don't speculate
right.
on issues. We try to find the documents and pour through thousands of pages of documents.
Especially because...
Looking for answers.
Especially because this topic is something where if you're trying to explain it to somebody who really doesn't understand what you're talking about, understand the weight of the implications, it's very easy for them to just brush you off and say, oh, this doesn't matter to me or whatever.
Right.
So can you explain as simply as possible what geoengineering is?
Well, the latest definition is the deliberate large-scale manipulation of the planetary environment mm-hmm. to counteract anthropogenic, which is man-made, climate change. The older definition is planetary-scale environmental engineering of our atmosphere, our weather, the oceans, and the Earth itself. So what you're talking about is deliberately creating artificial conditions for the planet on a very large scale. And the danger is you'll end up, you know, with all of us living in a terrarium. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the scientists said we have to live in the experiment.
Oh, that's very nice. It's especially nice of them to nominate us to live in it without anybody's consent. Doesn't it say in the U.S. code that it's illegal to experiment on the general public without their knowledge? Are you aware of that?
Yeah, there are laws against it, but there are exceptions big enough to drive a big truck through.
Oh, I see.
You know, so as in everything, there are exceptions for every reason they can think of. So basically, we have no protection in our country. We have less protection than you do internationally because there was a convention called NMOD that went into effect.
Tell the people about that.
At the United Nations in 1988. It banned the hostile manipulation of weather and climate and particularly dealt with electromagnetic weapons, which they say had never been used, but my research indicates they had been used. And the official reason given for moving toward that, we introduced identical resolutions with Russia mm-hmm. on it. And the official reason was our weather manipulation program in Vietnam. It's called Operation Popeye.
Right.
And that was to extend the monsoon season and muddy up the Ho Chi Minh Trail to prevent supplies from being brought in.
How was
when
that done?
When Congress found out about it, they just went berserk.
How did they do that? This is Ken, Pauline. Thanks for being with
yes.
us. How did they do that in Vietnam?
Well, as you know, they sprayed a lot of chemicals in Vietnam. The most common was Agent Orange, but they used cloud seeding. They still say only cloud seeding is being used, like in China, you know, for manipulating the weather for the Olympics. But there are many. I mean, that's 1950s technology.
So weather modification was being used in a defense realm even long before global warming became a concern?
Oh, yeah. And so it banned the hostile manipulation of weather over a period as short as one season of 3 months. But anything could be done if it was deemed to be research. So therefore, your big electromagnetic facilities like HARP and the one in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, HARP is in Alaska, that's our mm-hmm. electromagnetic facility, they're deemed to be research facilities.
What's the objective of HARP? Is that a government project?
Yes, it is operated by the military. And
specifically the Air Force, isn't it?
Yeah, Air Force and Navy, I believe. And they beam up 1 billion watts of microwave energy onto the ionosphere when they turn it on. Mm. And that's in a focused array. It's the only one in the world that has a focused array. And it's by far the strongest beam. So it has many, many military capabilities. You know, you can set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. You can steer the jet stream, all-important jet stream. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you can warm an area up or cool it down as you wish.
Do you think that that's...
You can steer weather.
Do you think that's actually been done?
It's being done every place, all the time.
That earthquakes have been brought to... Have occurred as a result of HARP?
Yes.
What's a telltale sign that that it's been used in an operation?
Well, I won't say that it's been HARP, but by these facilities.
Okay, because there's more than one.
You have lights that show up. in the sky, but they also show up in natural events.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a way to actually pinpoint where the electromagnetic pulse originates from. So, I think Tom Bearden is the best expert on the electromagnetic issues. And I frankly never even given, I've given a lot of speeches here in Greenwich and at the UN on weather as a weapon and weather manipulation, geoengineering. But I've never gotten into how do you create an earthquake. Basically, you add energy to an already unstable point, like a fault line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just have felt I would lose the audience totally. But if you're interested, I would certainly recommend Tom Bearden.
Okay. Isn't also Nick Begich another researcher who specializes?
Nick Begich is the best expert on our HARP system.
Oh, he specifically our HARP.
Well, that is the U.S., that is our
That name is specific.
Electromagnetic system. And he became concerned when they moved forward with this program and got local people in Alaska to be concerned because it would upset the shortwave radios that they mm-hmm. depend on.
Right.
You know, living in remote areas. HARP was originally located in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And had to be moved because it upset the controls for planes.
Oh, I see.
And so they moved it up to Alaska, and it sits on a, it's by Gakona, Gakona,
mm-hmm.
Alaska, and it sits on a natural gas field, which gives it power.
Hmm.
And so when they fire it up, you can see artificial auroral borealis as far south as Atlanta.
How do our leaders envision it might be used? Are there specific military situations where this would be useful? Would it be just useful as a threat to a rival nation?
Right, like a nuclear weapon, just a threat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the electromagnetic pulse weapons are the weapons of today. And I've been upset being in the disarmament community at the UN that they're not being dealt with at the UN. The Secretary General has an NGO committee, non-government committee on warfare. And they're not looking at this.
Right, like while governments
pulse weapons or weather as a weapon.
While governments can act and put on a show and say that they're disarming by, you know, dismantling nukes or something like that, they can still be stockpiling weapons that you don't even know exist.
And you can just fry a nuclear weapon where it sits. You can fry the components, the navigation components. So it makes it useless. I actually gave a speech at the environment conference called Never Take a Knife to a Gunfight.
Yeah.
And that was the evolution of warfare, that a lot of our weapons have become knives.
Well, they're just shows for the general public.
The enemies have bigger weapons, and so you can disable a tank, you can knock down a plane any place, any time.
Mm-hmm.
Create earthquakes, and you can hide behind Mother Nature's skirts.
Right. Yeah, you can say, oh, too bad an earthquake.
Military, then act as the rescuer.
Just to let people know
they've been doing this all the... You know, a lot of governments of the world have been deliberately manipulating the weather. I think that's what we're seeing with this extreme weather, extreme heat we've been having, and wild storms we're having here in Connecticut.
You're speaking very recently.
I mean, lightning for hours. Two nights ago, I couldn't sleep because the house was just lighting up with lightning.
So a lightning storm is a side effect of weather manipulation?
Well, you're seeing snow ushered in with lightning.
Mm-hmm.
They're calling it thunder snow.
Yeah, this past winter, we had quite a bit of that here in Connecticut.
Yeah,
if you just joined us, we're talking to Pauline Cantwell. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, Gus Cantavera. We're talking to Pauline Cantwell about weather modification, weather as used as a weapon.
Go ahead. You were talking about the weather, the lightning snow, thunder snow.
Thunder snow. You're seeing words being introduced in the weather reports. Killer lightning. Lightning can now kill people in their cars.
Mm.
It's totally different.
It's a pleasant thought.
And lightning goes up from clouds and mm-hmm. down from clouds. I mean, the lightning experiments are crazy. I mean, just really crazy. I have a house in Florida, and there's a lot of lightning experiments by the military base there. I can't remember which base. But anyway, there's just... I can see Long Island from my house, and last summer there was a storm that just kind of went a long distance on Long Island, and it just lasted forever. It was almost like a symphony, you know, where it would start here and then go down. And that's one sign of a manipulated lightning storm, because a normal storm will move through. You'll kind of count and know that it's so far away,
uh-huh.
you know, how close the lightning is to you.
Okay.
By coordinating it with the thunder.
Right, right.
But these storms just last forever. They just hold.
Uh-huh.
And I've been in Washington, D.C. when that's happened. And that night there were, or that day there were thousands of lightning strikes in Philadelphia. I'd taken the train through there.
Because we hear the reason for these prolonged storms and violent weather, you know, if you watch any of the mainstream news channels, they'll have a segment. I think Fox has one. It's called Extreme Weather.
Yes.
And every time there's some kind of flooding or lightning strike or anything like that, it's well, they insinuate that it's caused by global warming or climate change.
Yes.
So,
I would argue it's not. I would argue it's these. We have 66 weather modification programs ongoing west of the Mississippi, and these are corporate and water districts.
Mm-hmm.
The ones east of the Mississippi, they can opt out being listed, and this is by NOAA, our National Oceanic.
Oh, they don't have to be listed.
So they don't have to list them east of the Mississippi.
So a lot of these projects are
but
for
I'm hoping
corporate
to get
purposes.
The list of those east of the Mississippi.
A lot of these projects are for private business purposes, not necessarily
right.
for defense.
Yes, to keep fog off runways. Airlines will hire a weather modification company to make sure that the fog doesn't linger on runways. Hail mitigation. Insurance companies hire weather modification companies to make sure crops don't get damaged by hail.
Now, a skeptic would probably say, oh, that's an altruistic effort. You know, they don't want hail to damage crops. They don't want fog to crash planes. But what's a side effect of weather modification? Because you can't just...
Well, it's a myriad of chemicals. And, you know, they have a synergistic effect. And, of course, when you create weather in one place, it doesn't stay in that place. It moves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big snowpack program in Wyoming, I believe, and that is to bring runoff in the spring to Southern California for swimming pools and agriculture. And that program is bigger than the state of California. It's huge. So Rosalind and I have gone to Washington. She actually made a map showing all these programs, showing how many square miles they cover. And we took it to all the congressional offices and talked about these programs.
What was the response that you
received? These are only the ones listed by NOAA.
Mm-hmm. What was the response that you received?
Well, the people in the offices were... one thing they asked, where'd you get that map? And Rosalind said, I made it.
Yeah. You know? That's what's happening.
And what she did, she put how many square miles there were in each state and then showed that these programs were bigger than some of the states. And so anyway, it's amazing. And then on the back, we listed all the programs that tells who's doing it and why. And... some water districts or energy companies are doing it to make water for their hydroelectric plants.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I know when my husband had a hydroelectric plant in California, we suffered from a drought out there, and, you know, this ability wasn't there in those days. But now the citizens around these dams are concerned because of the chemicals being used to create rain.
What kind of chemicals are they?
Oh, I don't want to get in. I don't know. Rosalind would be the expert on that.
Well, from what I understand, there's barium salts and silver nitrate and aluminum is a key ingredient as well.
Yeah. Rosalind and I won't say what they're spraying, you know, like the jets.
Okay.
The contrails making persistent jet contrails that make clouds. We won't say they're spraying X, Y, and Z because we can't go up there and actually get it from the plane.
Right. The testing that's been done is basically just collecting.
What she does is track it in the water, the groundwater.
Right.
Well, how do jet contrails fit into this picture? What are jet contrails?
Persistent jet contrails, I think, are weather modification programs. And I use one book in my speeches. It's the 1992 report from our National Academy of Sciences. It's mm-hmm. a rather big book, 600 pages or so, and I got it, you know, from Amazon. It's published by our government. And they concluded that the cheapest way to mitigate global warming was to use jets, commercial jets, that were already flying because you didn't have to pay them to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could either, you know, there's different ways you can create clouds. That's one is by dirtying up the fuel, making them burn richer.
Mm-hmm.
And that does it, and then spraying certain things. And so it has been suggested that a fleet of 747s could be used.
Okay.
At very high altitudes. So I think your military planes are at higher altitudes. And then there's rockets that are being used. There was a rocket that went right over our house here in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
called, it was CARE Project, Charged Aerosol Release Experiment.
Right.
And that was September 19th of last year.
And that's easily found in the news.
The Navy and NASA, and they twittered that they were going to do this. And my next door neighbor saw it go over our house, spraying mm-hmm. aluminum oxide, which then creates an oscillucent cloud, which is only seen in the Arctic under normal situations, but it's being seen all over the world. I have pictures of them and from the Eiffel Tower, all over.
And what do they hope to accomplish with the cloud? What's the purpose?
Well, then they're perturbing with electromagnetic pulses. The paper said they would perturb it with electromagnetic pulses from HAARP in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, and Tromso, Norway. And they had Virginia Tech University involved, quite a few universities, NASA, Navy, and they've been doing experiments in Colorado, too.
And once they perturb it,
they're observing noctilucent clouds, but noctilucent clouds aren't seen.
And what would be the point of that? Is this to reflect the sun, or what is the point?
I have no idea.
So they're not really letting on.
I mean, I watched one be created the last nighttime shuttle launch in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
We watched it from our pier off of Barrier Island on St. Petersburg, Treasure Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see the aluminum, this shiny stuff being sprayed, you know, in the last stage. And then this cloud popped up, and they're like iridescent.
Mm-hmm.
You see them when you fly, and they like glow when the sun sets. So they're only seen when the sun is below the horizon, either at dawn or at sunset.
Okay.
And so I don't know exactly why. I do have the papers on it. I did put it in a speech here.
That's okay.
And it was military purposes.
If I'm looking up at the sky, I see a jet, Pauline, and I see, you know, a trail behind it. How can I differentiate between, say, an ordinary water vapor trail and a jet contrail?
Well, a persistent jet contrail lasts a long time, and it expands and covers a long area, whereas an ordinary contrail disappears pretty fast. That's just the moisture mixing with the exhaust from the jet.
So that's like what we're all used to seeing.
I grew up next to an Air Force base in Abilene, Texas, and, you know, we saw the jets coming and going, and our skies were bright blue, and we never saw this persistent jet contrails. We never saw these artificial clouds that we see now. Some are vertical, some are very hazy.
Right.
And
they're very, very high in the sky.
And now I'm seeing a lot of black. And
I've noticed the black ones.
Storms with carbon black, and I've seen a lot in the sky. We have a violent storm the next day. We had the tornado in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
The day after, I went down the beach and saw all these very unusual black clouds. And you know, I was seeing it in Florida, and so. I think the carbon black, and also it heats up.
Yeah,
you know, it makes it hotter. And so that could be a factor in why we're experiencing such extreme hot temperatures up here mm-hmm. this summer.
Now, the carbon.
But last summer was colder than normal. I never wore summer clothes last summer.
Right, right.
Because it was so cold.
I've read science journals where they talk about the use of carbon black and saying that they could steer a hurricane by making it warmer on the western side of the hurricane and causing it to make a U-turn in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that they talk about it in their journals as if it's fact, like it's been done. And, you know, do we know?
I'd like to see that because I really want to give a show. I have a radio show. Uh-huh. Here in Greenwich on Tuesday mornings, I would like to talk about the carbon black.
Right.
And while here in Greenwich, we had microbursts the other night. I guess it was in the evening.
So a geoengineering
down and, you know, real wild flat winds. You're seeing a lot what they call hurricane force winds.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think this is connected to the geoengineering. The geoengineering came out of our weapons labs, Lawrence Livermore in particular.
Okay.
Lowell Wood. And so I think the military has seized control of our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. They call it full spectrum dominance in a paper called Owning the Weather in 2025, which I know is posted on Connecticut Skywatch.
Right, website. Weather as a force multiplier, I think that
is. Yes, weather as a force multiplier.
Right.
And so now it's full spectrum dominance of space, of electromagnetic, and of weather.
But now this technology is tying into global warming, right? That there are scientists who feel that we should put things up in the sky in order to reverse the effects of global warming?
Yes, that would be the two methods of geoengineering.
Doesn't Al Gore own the patent to one?
Technical fix, you know, that we can't reduce carbon fast enough.
So what do they put up in the air?
The same
stuff, that's
right?
Where, if you read the documents in the National Academy of Science book, it says using airplanes would be the cheapest way, but they use rockets and stuff. But put particulate matter, sulfates, to mimic okay. Mount Pinatubo, which exploded in 1991. It erupted, and it released sulfur that cooled the planet. And then that led Paul Crutzen, who was a Nobel Prize winner for his ozone hole remediation, to publish a paper in 2006 calling for the release of sulfates into the atmosphere. And that pushed the whole topic of geoengineering into the mainstream. Before that, it was discussed behind closed doors. And other scientists were quite upset that he was coming open with this. So now there's a powerful group of scientists and venture capitalists and conservative think tanks.
So there's a lot of money to be made.
All coalescing around this idea.
So this is not a fringe idea anymore. This is,
no.
Yeah.
No.
Going as far back as it was 1968, I think, it was John P. Holdren, our current science czar. He wrote a book called Ecoscience, and in which they talked about how best to control climate on the planet. And they talked about using sulfates and aerosols in the air to reflect sunlight. And, you know, that was just one of the ideas. But that's over 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. This has been going on for a long time. It's not new.
I printed out an article here.
In fact, most people have never seen, the younger people have never seen natural weather.
Mm-hmm. I have an article here that I printed out from Science Daily from January 26th of this year. And it says, there's good news in there, but then they have to turn it around and say that it's also bad news. And it's the ozone hole is healing, which is amazing. But then on one side they say, but that's also going to exacerbate global warming. And they say the only way to fix this is that the reason there was a hole over Antarctica and that clouds were forming to block out the sunlight. And they say that once the ozone layer heals, it's going to keep in and trap in the heat. So what we need to do is use aerosol to create fake clouds to replace the ones that will dissipate once the ozone layer heals. And they say that, you know, we need to spray aerosols in the air, that it's a tried and true method. They use state-of-the-art global models of aerosols and two decades of meteorological data to predict that it would work. And, you know, this is just right in your face, but they don't use terminology or words that make it clear to the average person that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, well, for instance, geoengineering got a bad rap, so they kind of moved away from that term and started calling it mitigation, climate change mitigation. And, of course, people said, we're not in a period of global warming, we're in a period of cooling right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they switched to climate change. You know, and so anyway, it's a morphing of things. But in order to create this cloud, my notes say that you'd need the equivalent of one Mount Pinatubo eruption every 3 or 4 years. So if you put it in the stratosphere, and one of the projects you have wealthy individuals involved in this, such as Bill Gates,
mm-hmm.
and he has a proposal to create a fire hose to heaven.
Sounds like a great idea.
And that is using the sulfur that's up at the
how could that possibly
shale oil stands in Canada. And then you could liquefy that and pump it up into this fire hose and go up to the stratosphere. and create the cloud that way. And when you create it in the stratosphere, it goes around the Earth very fast, creates what was originally called Badikos Blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Russian who came up with this idea of making a blanket around the planet with a cloud cover. And
yeah, Pauline, I just want to get in one last point because we're almost out of time. But you had mentioned before the dangerous chemicals that are within the aerosols that they use to get the desired effects. And very recently, an article came out from the IFPRI, which is an agriculture organization. Oh, it's the International Food Research Institute. But they say that genetically engineered crops are going to be the savior of humanity. And one of the genetically engineered crops that they're creating is one with aluminum resistance. Now, why would we need an aluminum-resistant crop?
Right.
And where would it be coming from?
Right. And salt-resistant, another one of Bill Gates' trials, is cloud whitening experiments on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And he has proposed a project 10,000 square kilometers off the California coast, and that is using salt water to create reflecting clouds. But then when that comes and rains out over your crops, you're going to have a problem.
Right.
So it's all a technical fix for these problems. And we had problems with the there were waterfalls down on the Hudson River a few summers ago, and they were for tourists, you know, just a tourist attraction.
Uh-huh.
But they had to turn them off for most of the day because the salt water spray was coming up and killing the plants along the shore. So all of these, and that's what I said, we'll be living in a terrarium with
all
artificial
right.
trees, you know, genetically modified trees that don't pollinate, and genetically modified crops. Some of them are reflectant crops,
mm-hmm.
and then salt-resistant. Those had been seeded in the Louisiana bayous by plane. And so these are all being done.
So this is a completely humongous topic that we couldn't even possibly touch the fringe of in our 30
Absolutely.
Minutes together.
Thanks a lot, Pauline. That was a real eye-opener to us.
And I hope that the listeners will go and research it for themselves and take notes on what we've been talking about, because it's a very deep topic.
So, and they can go to Roslyn's website.
You fire off the websites for people.
AgricultureDefenseCoalition.org.
Mm-hmm.
And my website is aworldalert.com. And we have a lot of the documents. We have the hearings on geoengineering.
Great.
You know, documents on that. We recently had hearings with our House of Representatives, the committee, had hearings in conjunction with the UK Parliament. And we're waiting for the report from our government to come out. The UK Parliament is out already. And so we're going to be reporting.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Pauline. We really appreciate it.
And when is your radio show on?
My radio show is 9:30 Tuesday mornings, WGCH 1490 Greenwich. And it is podcast live at their website.
Okay.
Which I think is WGCH 1490.
All right.
I think if you just Google that, and then they're archived, the podcasts are archived.
Terrific.
And we've been talking a lot about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, or the volcano of oil, and the Corexit, and the geoengineering, and then the legislation being pushed through, because they really want to move forward with these geoengineering projects. There's a lot of money to be made
right.
when you use these as carbon offsets.
All right, well, we're out of time in this
okay.
segment, and we really appreciate you taking the time to join us and talk about this very important topic.
Okay,
and,
well, thanks for having
thanks
me.
Thanks very much, Pauline.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Hey, you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're streaming at WPKN.org, and this is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Cantavero, and we're filling in tonight for Scott Harris, the host of Counterpoint. And we're opening the lines to phone calls, so we'd be very interested in hearing what the callers' views are on weather modification or the war on terror or anything else that's on your mind. This is your airwaves, too. So please give us a ring at 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756. You know, Gus, while we're waiting for calls, we were talking a bit earlier about the change in policy with Afghanistan.
Actually, we have a call.
Oh, excellent.
All right, so I'm going to bring it up. Go ahead, caller.
Greetings. So does that explain the reason why the Obama administration doesn't sort of push a little harder for a climate change bill, because they're already changing the climate, and we don't want any bills that would get in the way of people manipulating the clouds for profit?
You know what? You could be exactly right. You know, there's no way to know. You know, what do you personally see about this? You sound like you have an opinion about it. Personally see?
Well, I guess, you know, you can have a position that can be changed fast too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because maybe she's right. Maybe we are in a cooling trend, and that the global warming thing is just a ruse, just to get you to believe one thing. They're making it warmer,
right?
So that it doesn't get cold, so we can grow crops. Now, notice that last night it was cold. Tonight it'll be down in the mid-50s. You know, when you get down to those temperatures tonight, the crops don't really grow very much.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that in my garden, that when it gets cold like that, nothing comes out of there. It gets nice and hot and stays that way at night. Things grow. So, and the farmer in town here, I'm in Easton, said to me that years ago, you could count on a frost by Labor Day. And now, one of the other farmers in town has been planting corn late enough for you to be able to buy fresh corn deep into October.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not just a month later. That's like almost 2 months more growing.
Okay.
Which is a lot. You know, but it is interesting if people are manipulating the weather everywhere. You know, it's the same thing Michael Crichton said in Jurassic Park. He said when they did the nuclear bomb project, it was a relatively controlled and small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
But he likened the genetically modifying of crops to just total anarchy, because you have thousands of people tossing things out into the environment and not really knowing what the long-term chain effects of those things that you've just introduced are.
And seemingly not caring at all.
Right.
Like, there's, we'll just take it as it goes and whatever.
You know, we got the same thing with somebody in town wants to build a development first. He said, we're going to build 21 10-bedroom houses. And we said, what you're really going to try to do is come back and say, you're going to build 105 two-bedroom units. In the watershed, there's actually two watersheds that the land feeds into.
Mm-hmm.
And it feeds to all the water supply companies here, from Trumbull all the way down to Greenwich.
Mm-hmm.
And it's solely for personal gain. They'll use the affordable housing statutes to try to ram this thing through, you know, overriding the town ordinances about zoning. The state has some, you know, guidelines, but they won't stand up and say, you know, one house in every two dry acres in the watershed is sensible. And this is how New York State's kept their water prices from skyrocketing, because they got all that land, huge clean watersheds. So you don't have to treat the water, because it's a lot harder to get all the garbage out, especially if people take a lot of medications, which they do. All that stuff ends up in the
right.
water, but it isn't taken out.
Right, right. You're. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you, caller.
You know, he brings up a lot of good points. You know, I wish I'd brought that one. It was the article about frogs and shrimp that are, because they're absorbing all of the antidepressants in the water, the runoff that goes out to places like the Gulf of Mexico. The shrimp, which obviously don't have emotions, but they have triggers, that defense mechanisms, and these shrimp are just emboldened and just swimming up to big crabs and not caring at all, and the shrimp just eat them. You know, because they don't have
they're,
any.
They become fearless. No,
they're fearless. Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. The guy makes a good point. We have another call. Good caller.
Yeah, it's Jim Motivalli, who happens to be on tomorrow night around this time.
Hi Jim. It's Gus and Ken here, filling in for Scott.
Yes, I enjoyed your show, and I like it that you take on topics like this. But I found that. Expert you just had on didn't document her findings very well.
Well, you know, you're right, but it's an incredibly deep topic, and for her to have documented everything that she said, we would have had to been on here for 3 hours.
Well, Jim, can you give us some of your thoughts on it?
Yeah.
Well, I just read what I think was an excellent book by the Rolling Stone contributing editor, what's his name, Jeff Goodell, and it's called Cooling the Planet, or How to Cool the Planet, mm-hmm. that's the title. And it's about some of what you were touching on there, which is the scientific intervention in climate. If we're not going to actually succeed in reducing our emission of climate gases, we got to do something else. And that's why the idea of large-scale intervention has come up mm-hmm. as being advanced by certain scientists. But there's a lot of reasons to be very trepidatious about that.
Well, Jim, do you subscribe to the views of, say, James Hansen of NASA that we're at or very near the tipping point in terms of global warming?
I totally subscribe to that, yes. I think we passed the tipping point. I mean, if you talk to somebody like Hansen, they would tell you that there's no way we're going to avoid 100 years of very serious global warming, even if we stopped burning coal tomorrow.
Why is that?
Because the life of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is at least 100 years. So the level we've established is not going to diminish just because we stop burning it anytime soon.
Well, you know,
which we're not going to do anyway.
No, we're not. Clearly, that's not going to happen. What about the report recently that says that, actually it's from last year, that says the Amazon rainforest is expanding in size due to the CO2 in the air, and that it actually processes 18 petagrams of carbon annually, which is 18 times or twice the rate of anthropogenic fossil fuel emissions.
Well, carbon dioxide does stimulate plant growth, but it would seem to me that the rate at which they're destroying the rainforests would more than compensate for that.
Well, actually, it goes on to say that most of the farmers have stopped farming because it's not profitable anymore because of the factory
farms.
Well,
it's the world's worst farmland. I can see why they would say that.
So, well, then you basically agree that they've stopped farming, the rainforest is expanding.
Well, it's not really farming that they do. It's cattle. It's mostly cattle grazing.
Well, either way, they were cutting down the trees, and they've stopped 10 years ago, and now it's growing again.
Well, I think that's pretty simplified. You've got to look at, as far as I know, and for one thing, you can't look at Brazil in isolation. You have to look at the destruction of world rainforests globally, and mm-hmm. you know, that's really accelerating in all kinds of places, from Indonesia to Borneo to many of the world's tropical rainforests are under attack in various ways.
Jim, what do you think of President Obama's record on the environment? Is he moving boldly enough? Is he supporting alternative fuels sufficiently?
Well, he's very good on the issues. You wouldn't you know, I don't really disagree with positions he takes, but I don't think he was bold enough or expended enough capital on trying to get through a climate bill, which is why we basically the Senate just dropped it, and there's not going to be any kind of cap and trade legislation. I mean, that's why you basically have to conclude that we're not going to be slowing down our emission of carbon dioxide. I mean, if you look at most of the countries in the world, they haven't really slowed down their emissions, even the ones that signed the Kyoto Treaty, so it's not very hopeful that way.
In your ideal world, if you were president, where would you put the investment in terms of alternative fuels? Would you put it in the wind and the solar and into ethanol? What would you do?
Well, I'm actually writing a book about electric cars, and that's what I write about most of the time. And Obama has spent some capital subsidizing electric car development. And I think what we're going to have to do is subsidize what's called early adopters to get people out of gas guzzlers and into electric vehicles, because right when they're going to be introduced, there's going to be a fairly high price premium on them. In fact, they're just announcing tomorrow the price on the Chevy Volt, and it could be fairly high. So subsidies help people buy them. And I think that's really good. I think we should be investing heavily in what I would call a utility scale wind and solar.
Could you see a day when we'll have this perfect national electric grid and we'll have a decentralized power system where I would have solar panels on my house or a windmill or something like that, and that I could be feeding stuff in all day long, getting credits and then using it up later on in the day, and I'd plug in my car so that I would be my self-sufficient energy source?
Well, that is feasible, but it's basically dependent on what we call a smart grid. And the problem is we have a very, very dumb grid. If in my neighborhood, for example, I'm using a huge amount of electricity, the utility has no way of knowing I'm doing that. The only way they know there's a problem is when there's a power outage. When you think that the grid is that dumb, it can't identify a spike in electricity usage any more than that it's coming in from one general area, from one transformer. What we need is a very interactive, smart grid, and that is one of the major.
How much
areas.
Money are we talking about there? We just spent $1 trillion in the war on terror. How
well,
much?
We'd spend another trillion building that.
So it is. It's a mammoth. It's not tweaking the current grid. We're talking about a huge,
largely
enterprise.
Replacing the current grid.
So we're like the interstate highway system.
Well, it's been
like
said, for instance, that you could take the wind capacity of just a few states. And even just say the Dakotas and Texas, the wind capacity of those that general area would be enough to power the whole electric grid of the U.S. The problem is that it's not where you need to use it. We don't have a way of getting electricity from the Dakotas to New York, as an example. So what we need is a grid that's national in scope and uses the latest technology and it's interactive so that utilities can see where the loads are and would also enable a lot of wind and solar use. But as I mentioned before, I like to see support for utility-grade wind and solar. I mean, you're putting a little wind generator on your house is a nice thing, but what we really need is a lot more of the Cape Wind project, you know, ones that could actually replace power plants.
Mm-hmm.
And I just heard an interesting presentation on utility-grade solar. And if you look at the solar capacity of some of our desert areas, it's really great. And these large-scale solar plants, I think, are really interesting. They tend to use focusing mirror technology. I think that stuff is very great potential. Again, generate utility-grade levels of electricity.
Well, now we have some ideas on how to spend the $1 trillion we're going to save when we end the war. But thank you so much for calling in, Jim. We're going
to let other people have a say. But I do believe that, you know, the government's capable of all kinds of things, but let's make sure we document it properly.
All right. Well, thanks very much for calling, Jim.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we're going to be bringing on in a moment. Our next guest will be Rick Rosoff, and do you want to go to that now? Do we have another caller?
We do.
Well, let's take a call.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, am I on the air?
You
sure.
Are.
Thank you for calling.
Yes, my name is John Brennan. I'm calling from Litchfield, Connecticut, and I just heard Pauline Cantwell speak about the geoengineering.
Right.
I set up with some other people a website called Connecticut Skywatch.
Oh.
Which she mentioned briefly.
Yep.
And we have a lot of information there, but one word that we use, and Pauline doesn't use, we use the word chemtrails.
Mm-hmm.
Pauline likes to use the word geoengineering, and that's understandable. California Skywatch with Rosalind Peterson, they are the same. They do not use the word chemtrails. The reason we use chemtrails is it is chemical trails coming from the planes.
Right.
Some of these planes are KC-10s, KC-135 type tankers, which are former military planes converted for this aerial spraying. And I have to say, right over the Litchfield County, in Dutchess County, New York, it's just incredible to see the sky turned into a bleached mess after these parallel lines merge together from the drifting chemical in the atmosphere. It literally puts a blanket in and turns a nice blue sky day into a cloudy mess.
Now,
I'm a former landscaper, and I basically had to quit the job because of the amount of bad weather last year and the year before. I also think that people who have children suffering with asthma should look into this because the health effects of the chemicals coming down. As you mentioned, there's barium salts, aluminum oxide,
right.
Sulfur hexafluoride is another very dangerous chemical, which is a tracer that they mix in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of government denial, media blackouts. Our local weather forecast every morning, Joe Fury comes on, and it's a big blah, blah, blah. You know, this is going to happen. The jet stream is being manipulated. He never mentions that. He may not know about it. In fact, I really believe the meteorological people are living in a sort of another century. They're completely out of touch.
Well, there's videos all over YouTube. If you go to YouTube, you just type in chemtrail geoengineering, persistent
right.
jet contrails, you're going to find a whole boatload of stuff. And there's one particular, meteorologist where he is showing the satellite footage showing that there is military sprays going on, and he says, now look, you can see that there's a crisscross pattern here, and that's military shaft that's going to be going on for the next couple of days, and don't be alarmed, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I saw that video, and that would probably be something different again. Even History Channel did a documentary on the weather manipulation. I think it was on what a series called That's Impossible.
John, what do you think is the purpose of the chemtrails that you observe in Connecticut?
I think it's a multi-pronged purpose. Sadly, I have to say, having read the United Nations Agenda 21 for depopulation, they want the depopulation of the planet down to around 500 million of us. It's possible that it's a long-term soft kill of the population. It's also used for probably military radar blocking stopping the satellites of other countries looking at our military bases. But then again, that doesn't make sense because they can see right into the ground now using these penetrating sound devices and, you know, topography, I think they call it. They know where the oil is even. So if they can see underground, they can certainly have no trouble seeing through the clouds, I would think.
The last caller brought up a point saying about documentation, and I've researched this issue ad nauseum for years now, you know, going back to 10, 15 years ago when I first started to notice this stuff. And, you know, I know that there's plenty of documentation out there, but do you have any choice sources that you'd like to share?
Yeah, well, I just had to say this. You know, people have said to me locally here who don't believe in the chemtrail thing, they think it's just normal jet contrails, and they think we made the word chemtrail up. Well, actually, the first mention of the word chemtrail was in Dennis Kucinich's Space Preservation Act of 2001. And this was known as HR 2977, and it made reference there to all sorts of different military psychotronic weaponry, and
right.
I think at the end of it, it mentioned the word chemtrails, and that was actually, he was tapped on the shoulder and said, Dennis, that's got to be taken out, and they redrafted it, and it was taken out, and it didn't pass. It was to ban the use of these militarized weather weapons. So, you know, the lightning storms that we've seen around here
Ms. Cantwell.
Yeah, Ms. Cantwell talked about the lightning storms are getting deadly serious, and it's only going to get worse. So you're going to see your weather get worse and worse, and you're going to wonder why, unless you listen to me and listen to the other people who are talking to you about the geoengineering and the chemtrails. I mean, it is not safe to have a landscape crew out the minute the lightning starts. Now, you are likely to get hit.
Thank you so much for calling, John. What was your website again?
ConnecticutSkyWatch.com. And another, Aerosol Crimes on YouTube is a very good video to view.
Thank you
very much
for calling in, John. Good night.
See? It's a topic people really care about.
That's very good. And John's putting his time in to let other people know about what's going on. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to be joined by our next guest, Rick Rosoff, who's going to talk about the expansion of the U.S. military beyond Iraq and Afghanistan. So please stay tuned. And then after that, after we speak with Rick, we'll take some more phone calls.
Where the road is dark and the seed is sown, where the gun is cocked as the bullets comb, where the miles are marked.